Good morning. My name is Alexandra Schwartz. I'm the curatorial assistant for the Modern Women's Project here at MoMA and the coordinator of the Feminist Future Symposium. I'm very pleased to introduce our next panel, Writing the History of Feminism, which I think in view of our last conversation will be an interesting discussion to have. We have four speakers. We'll start with Uta Mehta-Bauer, Associate Professor and Director of the Visual Arts Program in the Department of Architecture at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and a very distinguished curator. Next, we'll have our own Connie Butler, the Robert Lehman Foundation Chief Curator of Drawings here at MoMA, to be followed by David Joslett, Professor and Chair of the Department of History of Art at Yale University, and finally, Griselda Pollack, Professor of the Social and Critical Histories of Art and Director of the Center for Cultural Analysis, History and Theory at the University of Leeds. So without further ado, Uta Mehta-Bauer.
Sorry to rush, but MoMA maybe should have special restrooms for the speakers. Okay. Passageways, four artistic voices from in-between space. Looking at a long list of renowned speakers at this conference at the Museum of Modern Art and a large and equally renowned audience here and actually listening to the live stream that is in operation to accommodate such high demand, I find myself preferring to be another, or rather many others, as to quickly quit this reality in favor of the in-between spaces of theatrical in what I want to talk about this morning. And also, I'm a little bit under time pressure because as a non-native speaker, I might read too slow. First of all, I want to thank all the many people that informed my feminist practice, men and women alike. And I would like to thank Sarah Peters for her initial encouraging talk to Glenn Lowry to make this happen, and everyone involved in the Modern Women's Project Committee at MoMA for the invitation to this illustrious conference. Feminist discourses are as important as ever. So let me also say how pleased I am that younger artists and protagonists within the art world have taken up the cause. Pleased and astonished too that it has received the ultimate accolade of a MoMA conference. After 100 years of women movement, the question regarding the future of feminism thus gains an almost anachronistically hip status, it seems. The reality of everyday feminism is, of course, still a much less glamorous, and which is my field of action. Again, it's more a field of oriented toward guerrilla tactics. And I must state, I'm not that optimistic as I have been in my younger years. Not about the future of feminism, but of the condition of our planet today. And people have mentioned before, like the lack of still a more kind of global communication, and I think that's very much on stake. And I think an economy of fear is not there to help to reduce that. And it just reminded me of one statement of Gandhi when he was asked what he thinks about Western civilization, and he responded, "It might be a good idea." In the politics of the theatrical, and also in the theatrical of politics, here I find an exciting and revealing scenario unfolding the theoretical, a space that seems to offer some room for maneuver or a retreat, speaking of today, into the temporary, an exile of the imaginary, and this is the title of an exhibition currently showing at the Generali Foundation in Vienna. And it evokes a complete contrast to the everyday spaces that are completely predetermined and predefined from outside, or even worse, subjected to self-control. The panel this morning includes three distinguished speakers who are actually experts in Syrian art history. So this is a further reason why I feel the freedom and take the freedom to present four artistic approaches that I have found inspiring to bring in from my position as a curator and from my current research. And I know such panels and such timing is always a moment of large exclusion. I'm interested in these approaches because they relate to my investigation of the renewed use of the theatrical spaces and theatricality as a strategy in current artistic practices. I would like to thank the four artists for the opportunity to show excerpts of their works, and sure they are much longer, and please also take my apologies for the quality of the screening and also for the editing, I did it myself. So this is whom I want to thank, and it was mentioned before, it's Lorna Simpson, who is actually in an editing room at this moment, so she can't be here, for her two-channel projection corridor, Judith Berry, who is also at a conference in San Francisco for Voice Off, a 99 video installation, Constanze Ruhm from Austria for rehearsal, a chat room generated screenplay located in several media spaces, and Joan Jonas for excerpts of her performance, The Shape, The Scent, The Feel of Things, that the American performance and video art pioneer presented at Dia Beacon the last 2 years. This selection is based, as mentioned, partly on my own personal work with the artists, but also on my interest in the theoretical and historical systems of reference with which and within these works act and experiment. These four works use different methods and come from different angles, but they all generate a theoretical investigation of the systems of reference they contain, which are very deliberately set up by the artists. Using theatrical strategies, they generate temporary spaces for experimental action, create unfamiliar proximities and encounters, and thereby engender unexpected experiences and insights for their audiences. It was precisely this opportunity to be forced to observe from an outside position what is happening within these stage spaces that aroused my interest. The English writer Virginia Woolf called for a room of oneself for every woman as a prerequisite for independent creative thinking as early as 1929, and the book became the most quoted text in the New Woman's Movement. But is this room still more unimaginary than a real space even today? And is it not precisely this imagined room or space that can offer women an experimental zone free of attributions from outside, beyond the spaces in which real life, or bare life, as the Italian philosopher Giorgio Agamben puts it in Homo Sacer, is so thoroughly inscribed, and which it so thoroughly permeates, leaving no freedom to inscribe something new or different. And was it not an imagined space where Wolf's Orlando wandered through space and time, changing rules and roles and gender, but sure, without losing her and his privileged social status? And it is true that in the now so popular virtualmyspace.com, everyone furnishes her or his own room of one's own. But for me, this is this kind of space, whether real or in virtuality, marks out individualized strategies of demarcation rather than opening up supra-individual freedoms. So what is happening with the spaces of the community and the so-called public space? Well, not much of it left. And virtual space itself is structured by equally virtual claims of ownership and integrated into the predominant capitalist structure of our world by means of domains that are bought and sold in real cash. All this increasingly pushes back the question whether and where there might be still open spaces in the rational system that extends across the whole globe. I prefer to depart the here and now of historically scripted spaces of reality contaminated by territorial struggles, an escape to the still open neither nor non-spaces of theatricality. There I can find at least a temporary free space that I need within the pressures of our everyday for experimenting with the production of theory by different means. And to some people that might sound a little bit conservative at this moment, but I think sometimes we are so strangled by the pressures of the everyday, we really lose focus sometimes where we want to go. As a German philosopher, Martin Heidegger, and believe me, he is not one of my favorites, brought to debate in his essay, Science and Reflection, what constitutes reality within which human subjects move and maintain themselves, end quote, what is real in relation to theory, quote, end. Again, quote, the word theory stems from the Greek word theorein. The noun belonging to it is theoria. Peculiar to these words is a lofty, mysterious meaning. The verb theorein grew out of two root words, theatricality and horao. Theatricality is the outward look, the aspect in which something shows itself, the outward appearance in which it offers itself. Plato names this aspect in which what presences, so what is eidos. To have seen this aspect, I deny, is to know. The second root word in theorein is horao, which means to look at something attentively, to look it over and over, to view it closely. Does it follow that theorein is then horan, to look attentively on the outward appearances wherein what presences becomes visible, and through such sight, seeing to linger with it, quote end. So doesn't this non-space of the theatrical open up a surface for experimentation in which fictional characters break out of the written and scripted spaces of history and of the cozy prisons of our everyday, leaving the grid of middle-class consumerist phantasmagoria, and we can follow them, their voices, as they go? Immigration into an imagined, projected space which cannot be possessed because it's non-existent, a space that neither belonging to, that is neither belonging to anyone nor can be expropriated. This is not such a bad option. And in a totally medialized society, isn't this imagined in-between space that can be continually redefined, just as real or unreal as the constructs of historiography itself? What have feminisms really achieved, let's say in the art world? Where and on whom have their theoretical and political struggles really had an impact? If, on the one hand, you consider the art world's business ability to carry on regardless, then the answer has to be feminism has achieved a lot. And yet it's far too little if you look at the untiring and mostly unpaid work of so many women all over the world, over more than 100 years of women's movement, decades of women's gender, transgender, and queer studies, and years of very active LGBT activism. Of course, life has changed, not only in terms of equal opportunities for men and for women, and also for ethnic groups. There is no doubt about that. This can also be seen in Lorna Simpson's video piece, Corridor. I think that the question of class identity is also visible here, has been neglected in recent years in theoretical political discourses on art. Whereas it does not play a central role, whereas it does play a central role in the discourse of precarious labor, particularly within the anti-globalization movement. We are again confronted with segregation of societies along old and new class lines. Even today, communities of shared interests have taken the place of traditional social classes. Debates on precarious labor, the reflection of the post-colonial condition, are conducted in an art context in Europe and Latin America, but they would not sit so easily within the current boom of the newly emerging, what could even say insane, US-American Chinese art market, where art is bound to another system of representation, the one of the rich and the beautiful. Coco, forget about the war. And here I want to go to show you some examples, and I hope I technically will manage. And can you take down the light? I hope I'm able still to read. So what has changed for me as a feminist? What changes have inscribed themselves into my idea of myself? Or is myself still another, even if this other has been readjusted? And when I look on all to myself, to my collected self-doubt and conversations with myself, oneself, is certainly many selves, many whose voices, I'm afraid, are not only confident, but also with their buts and maybes, frequently rock the unsure foundation on which my own accomplishments rest. How can this be the case in spite of all the emancipation and development I have experienced in theory and political reality? In spite of all my successes in revealing structural social mechanisms through acute analysis. But do these issues still interest me at all? Today I'm no longer at all involved in querying the feminist self. I'm much more bothered by the far more urgent search for the political space that would allow me to outline an emancipated self, to construct it at the first place. This means that the tried and tested constellation of gender, race, and class, and let me add here, age, must be reactivated. In Corridor, Lorna Simpson gives us an insight into the daily routines of two black women shown in parallel, routines that the women experience in differing temporal and cultural spaces, and thus under different conditions. As uninvited witnesses and guided by the voyeuristic gaze of the camera, in Corridor we observe these young women, both performed by Kenyan artist Wangechi Mutu, whom you will hear this afternoon. One of them seems to be in the 17th century, by candlelight, she goes about her everyday business, while the other does exactly the same, but now in a modernist setting of the 20th century, two scenarios in which nothing special happens, nothing special takes place. The mute depiction, and sorry for that, it's a bit dark. The mute depiction of everyday life are accompanied only by music. In the 17th century house, we hear the songs of pianist Blythe Tom Wiggins, and in the modernist house, what else? Modern jazz. The Coffin House in Newbury and the 1938 home of Izzy and Walter Gropius in Lincoln may suggest a historical reality, but what Simpson does with these two settings is draw us into the heterotopic space of a corridor, a passageway between the historiography of one screen and the other. Both protagonists are situated in New England, one of the US pioneer states, and yet the circumstances of their lives in different moments of time are transformed. Simpson's double projection of these two figures, both performed by the same woman, has the effect of involving the two protagonists in a seemingly silent dialogue, more strongly expressed by the clash of the music styles. It is precisely this staging, this process of observation in the darkness out of the projection space that gives us, as viewers, the opportunity of free association. The apparently exchangeable settings and apparently identical action and the absence of text within these textures allow us to enact our own dialogue between the epochs and the protagonist's conditions. The female game with role ascriptions and multiple identities has already been considered at length at art historical and feminist contexts. The role-playing in Adrian Piper's early 1970s cycle, A Mythic Being, or Cindy Sherman's never-ending variations on female role clichés in her untitled film stills, and Regina Müller's alter ego Regina, are just a few of many examples of a critical look at gender roles and also of an ironic, playful approach to them. Also, makers of camp films such as Jack Smith, John Waters, and Ulrike Oettinger, to name just a few, have used theatrical exaggeration or queer characters and varying combinations of gender to provoke not only the straight middle class, but plenty of feminists too. For many years, I worked myself to draw attention to important women artists who were underrepresented at large shows like the 1992 Documenta of Jan Hoot or in museum collections such as MoMA. I took what might be called direct action in curatorial projects such as Informationsdienst from 1992 to 1994, where I collaborated with the artists Sandra Hastenteufel and Tine Geisler from Stuttgart. Or First Story, Women Building, New Narratives for the 21st Century, a project in Porto in Southern Europe, where groups like Women on Waves, as it was mentioned yesterday, from Holland, LSD from Spain, or Dyke TV, Lesbian Television from Lesbians for Lesbians from the United States, presented feminist activities of other women, women's groups and networks to a broad public, while at the same time a trial was taking place in Oporto, in which a midwife was accused of performing illegal abortion and was sentenced to several years of prison, and this in the year 2001. I'm actually not concerned with the future. It is the present that bothers and frustrates me. Looking for a theoretical tool that supports me to go ahead, I'm regaining more and more pleasure from ephemeral practices that resist appropriation and whose permanent processes of formation and dissolution inspire me more than any study of one-sidedly formulated historical attribution. This is why at the moment I'm interested in forms of practice, in forms of practices that make us use the theatrical in a particular time-based media, such as performance, film, or video. And of course, I know that a large number of artists have used theatricality in artistic strategy for a long, long time. Potential of the voice as such. The voice has no future and no past. It is not language, no text. It just is. But what is it if it has no space, if you can hear it, but you don't see it? I'm interested in voice off in view of Barry's investigation of voice and voices and theatricality versus the everyday, which the work spatializes in a double projection. The space of the work is divided by a wall in the middle on which images are projected from both sides. And I have cut them counterpart here. The viewer can walk through the double space constructed by the artist and then decide from which viewpoint to take in voice off. We hear the voices of women at the workplace of, let's say, a freelancer, voices that are driving him mad and making him so aggressive that he grabs a golf club to try to get closer to the cause of the noise. The voices, while in the dark of the non-space on the other side, the ephemeral women seem unperturbed by the fact of someone is loudly trying to break into their space. And isn't it one of the issues here, that smoothing of unwanted voices in so many violent acts, whether this is on the so-called voice of the people, women's voices, the voices of minorities, voices that we cannot understand and we find unsettling, voices that make us feel threatened and that we have to silence so as not to have to face up to them. Theatricality as a political strategy used to deconstruct a sanctimonious reality is also to be found in Molière's critique of authority, of the tradition of Italian commedia dell'arte, of Artaud's Genie and Beckett's use of the absurd, and in the surrealism of Cocteau, right up to the more popular musical didactic plays of Brecht and Weill. Constanze Ruhm's Rehearsal is a work in several parts from 2003 and 2004, a piece that the Austrian artist has been working on for many years in highly diverse formats and media. She investigates the multiple roles, ex-characters, in very specific female stereotypes, which she extracts and isolates from seven cult movies, and I think most of them are actually in the collection of MoMA. Seven actresses whose profession is imitation, repetition, reenactment, playing the text given to them and making the accompanying gestures present to show a never-ending variations on the return of the ever same. The eternal painfully repeated rejections, loops in cinematic and theatrical non-spaces, showing biopolitical definitions and mechanisms of reproduction in a Beckett-like mode.
sehr klare Botschaft des Unbewussten.
Was bist du?
The path of these seven female protagonists from movies that made art cinema history come together in a waiting room of an airport, a non-space akin to those Mark O'Shea described in his 1995 book, Non-Places, Introduction to an Anthropology of Supermodernity. In this theatrical space, they talk at cross purposes. We become painfully aware just how cliché the roles are that we ourselves play every day, influenced by popular media, pretty much defined in the meantime by reality TV. These encounters automatically lead to misunderstandings, as the re-scripted, repetitive, and ritualized acts shown generate free spaces for actions as a kind of an infinite loop, a fantastical, repetitive, Möbius strip from which there is no way out. Room uses a setting that is clearly recognizable as a theatrical space, although she employs the medium of film. She strategically utilizes stylized theoretical form to bestow on the conversations of the characters from the movies as a sense of isolation and alienation, and thereby also clarity. Here, theatrical space serves as a method of distancing that provides a focus on the statements and the roles. In the performance, The Shape, The Scent, The Feel of Things, named for a text by Hilda Doolittle, Joan Jonas performs as the personification of the iconographic figure of melancholy. In this piece, she shows through the convalescence of the German-Jewish cultural historian Abi Warburg from a nervous breakdown in a Swiss sanatorium. As a demonstration of his full recovery, Warburg wrote a lecture about the rituals of the Pueblo communities of the American Southwest. Jonas shares Warburg's deep fascination with ritual and pagan practices and their meaning and also their healing qualities. Being melancholy, the artist investigates these rituals and also plays out a further reference to Warburg, who has written an art historical work on the iconography of Albrecht Dürer's Melancholia and has also himself suffered, obviously, from a tendency to melancholy. Jonas gives a voice to his visions and creates a space for his ideas. In her version of Warburg's story, she plays out rituals that she herself had come to know and appreciated early in her artistic career in encounters with Hopi shamans. The impressions this made on her was deep and lasting. In The Shape, The Scent, The Feel of Things, she once again takes up themes and formats of ancient Greek theater, as she has done earlier in her work for Documenta 11, Lines in the Sand, about Helen of Egypt. However, she enriches the drama with live music, like the silent movies, and expands the theatrical space by means of visual overlapping in multiple projections, creating interlocking layers of various cultural spaces and leading us to a complex audiovisual imaginary world. This is not the pathos of experience of expressionist theater. However, for Jonas, characters take us on a journey into an in-between space where it is possible to show something that cannot be easily explained in words. sorry, Lorna, for messing it up in the beginning. These four artistic positions all differ in form and content, and they are all based on different approaches. But all of them make use of strategies and techniques of the theatrical, albeit in different ways. It is precisely the theatrical in-between space that Jonas' performance and the works of the other three artists I presented here today in excerpts employ a kind of deliberate, discursible free space. This space is all the more crucial in times characterized by rigid discourse, unproductive antagonisms, and the pressure of everyday political situations, all of which tends to paralyze us rather than inspire us. Spaces are opened up in which it is still possible to make new inscriptions and to then again erase the texts that are emerging in them without causing collateral damage. This is, as I have said, the exciting and inspiring foundation of my current research on theatricality. Theatricality as a tool for experimenting with new, still playable spaces for the continuation of a still necessary polyphonic feminist discourse, freed at least for some short moments from the oppressive reality of the space that currently envelops us. Thank you.